Warning! This program will contain massive spoilers and profanity for absolutely everything we discuss. Consider yourself warned.
Welcome to Trillion Amongst the Mangoes, I forget what we called it. This is I am Gage Topolsky, your awkward knowledge monger, and
I am Zeev Noam, and I don't think I actually have a name.
Very good boy?
Yeah, very good
very
boy.
Very good boy.
Very good boy, we'll go with that.
CJ's out this week, so we are watching, me and Zeev are gonna do an episode together.
Yay!
Probably, and I suddenly realized that when we were discussing about what movie we're gonna talk about together, it was just after, CJ mentioned that he won't watch certain movies when a certain thing happens. And we'll get into that. Mm-hmm. Fairly quickly into the movie, and I realized one of the reasons why you wanted to watch this movie with me.
Yeah, this was one of those movies that when I watched it, I was like, oh, Gage is gonna love this, and I really need to hear CJ and Gage talk about it. But then I found out that CJ doesn't listen to like a movie because the watch movies where a specific thing happens, and I was like, okay, well, Gage will still enjoy it.
Yeah,
we can still talk about it.
Movie that we're looking at is 2000's Wonder Boys, directed by Curtis Hanson, written by Michael Chabon, screenplay by Steve Novels? Novels?
I think. I think so, yeah. I don't know how to say it.
Yeah. Starring Michael Douglas as Grady Tripp.
Grady.
Grady. No one says his first name in this movie.
Nope. Everyone just calls him Tripp.
Yeah. Tobey Maguire as James Lear.
Mm-hmm.
Very creepy in this.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Fits very well for him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Robert Downey Jr. as the editor, Terry Crabtree.
2000s Robert Downey Jr.
2000s,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Iron Man wouldn't come out until 2004, 2006.
Right. So this was before he got big. I think this was like in between like his addictions and arrests and stuff too.
This was definitely after his Charlie Chaplin movie though. That was in the early 90s. Right. And finally in a very small role for an actress of her talent, Frances McDormand as Sarah Gaskell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She should have had more to do in this movie, honestly.
Underutilized.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
CJ has just informed me in all caps, Iron Man came out in 2008, you swine. So he's listening in as in true producer role today.
Okay. So at the risk of still sounding okay, we should limit the amount of insults we throw at him, right?
It's fine. It's fine. He was okay here. This movie was weird because it was just. We'll get into it.
I do want to point out when you previewed the movie last week in your ambulance episode.
Yes.
You mentioned that it was a drama. And when I listened to it, I was thinking, I thought it was more of a comedy than a drama. But then like after rewatching it and like. Paying attention to it a little bit more, I was thinking, yeah, no, it's a drama with jokes. I can see where you got that.
It's kind of a dark dramedy, I guess. Like the other thing is, I had no idea what this was really going into it, other than the one sentence description on IMDb,
which was
an English professor tries to deal with his wife leaving him, the arrival of his editor who has been waiting for his book for 7 years. And the various problems that his friends and associates involve him in. And that's just like the vaguest description.
Yeah, that's like explain a movie in a sentence, and that doesn't really say everything.
No, it doesn't really say anything, which is one of the things I find weird about this movie. We'll get into it. Let's get into it.
Yes.
You ready to get into it?
Let's do this.
All right. So the movie starts with, I'm going to keep calling him Trip because I'm going to keep tripping over his character's name.
Sounds good.
Reading a short story by James Lear. And then there's a voiceover narrating what he's doing in the past tense. The voiceover will continue throughout the film, narrating in retrospective.
I like the narration in this movie, honestly.
I was iffy.
Yeah.
Like, it feels overwritten at times, ironically. I guess that's the point.
Yeah, like, the way that he says it, like, the way that he talks in the movie, it's like the way that a writer would kind of write the story, which I think maybe is kind of the point of it, but
it comes off as overly wordy, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it. Like it's there's no way to write a book or a movie about, I was going to wait into the end of this, but this is so much of this movie that it's hard not to comment on this. It's hard to write any book or movie about writing where someone is very clearly putting themselves into the role of the writer and talking about writing without sounding pretentious.
Yes. Yeah. I completely see where you're coming from on that.
Yeah. And it's bumpy, but it kind of works here. I think the movie gets weird enough that it works.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it definitely works towards it. And it kind of, I mean, considering it's a movie that's all about writers.
Yeah.
That kind of fits its theme sort of in a way.
I guess. But that's the other problem. This isn't. Okay. Mm, wow. The thing is, this movie gets kind of meta about itself in a very subtle way. And we'll get to it.
Okay.
We'll get to it.
I really want to talk about that at some point. So
I do too. I do too. We'll get to it. I know.
All right. We'll get to it. Sounds good.
All right. James Lear, everything that Tobey Maguire's James Lear does in this movie is a cry for help, attention, and he should really be seeing a therapist every other day.
Oh, hands down. Yeah.
Yeah.
Side note, though, Tobey Maguire, really good for this role.
He was creepy and good in this. Yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get to that too.
I have notes about James Lear. We will get to it.
Yeah. So the town, Pittsburgh, where the university is preparing for WordFest, a celebration of writing and writers. And Trip goes to pick up his editor from the airport, Terry Crabtree. Try saying that five times fast.
I'm not going to.
No, me neither. who has met a woman on the plane, which Trip is quick to point out she's a transvestite, and I am hopeful and was pleasantly surprised to have their character not be handled. To be handled with respect.
Yes. I think they did an okay job at that. It's pretty progressive for a 2000s movie. I will give it that.
Yeah.
But just, I feel like saying that she's a transvestite in every scene that she's in.
It's just like, yeah, it's one of those early kind of lazy jokes where it's just like, hey, look, someone is different, therefore it's kind of funny.
Yeah.
Yeah. Doesn't land well nowadays.
It doesn't, no.
Yeah. Also, I wasn't sure if they were using the word properly, if they were trans or if they were a cross-dresser. Transvestite is synonymous with cross-dresser.
Right.
And we see that they are, which at least they did the... Well, yeah, in a movie about writing and storytelling, at least they got the grammar right.
Yeah. Hey, you got to give him credit for that.
A little bit.
Yeah.
I don't have to give credit to anyone on anything.
That is fair. That is a good point.
They, so Crabtree is in more or less rolling off, surviving off of Tripp's last book, which was called The Arsonist's Daughter.
Mm-hmm. Which was written like 7 years before this movie.
Yeah, so he's put all of his hopes and dreams on this writer to have his book finished.
Yeah.
They go to a party at the university as he tries to awkwardly, as Tripp awkwardly set, dances around the fact that his novel isn't going so well. We are greeted by the university's
It's going.
We'll get to it.
Yep, we will get to it.
They're greeted by the university's chancellor, Sarah Gaskett. That word threw me off because it's actually kind of a more British term for like president. Usually in the States, president of the university is the president of the university. So chancellor just trips me up mentally.
It does, yeah. I can see it.
We are introduced to Poe, the head of the English department's dog, a blind pit bull mix. Couldn't really tell. Who knows that Tripp is secretly seeing Sarah behind the husband's back, and is not a fan of Tripp.
Right.
Yeah. Ironically, the husband is more blind than his own dog to the situation.
This movie does irony very well.
Yeah, no, it's good.
Yeah.
Upstairs at the party, they collapse into bed and hug, and she tells Tripp that she's pregnant. Mm-hmm. He tells her that his wife left him. And Sarah just kind of suggests, okay, I'll leave my husband and we'll have this baby together. And there's this quiet, contemplative moment where it's very clear that neither one of them actually want that.
Yeah.
Like, it's just like, it's the thing is, we don't really do dramas like this so much on Mangoes because, like, there's smaller little emotion things that you can call out sometimes in action movies because they shine so brightly in just random action. But here, everything comes down to micro expressions, just to like casual glances, little movements. And this movie does that very well. And I mean, it would. There's a lot of really good actors in it.
Yeah. You have to pay attention to a lot of the subtle things like in the movie itself, like in the back.
One of Tripp's students rents a room from him. She is Hannah, as played by Katie Holmes, who is adorable in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
She's also thirsty for that writer dick.
Oh, like, any writer she could get her hands on, honestly.
A little bit, yeah. We see her chatting with Q, a writer who has completed 17 different novels, one every 6 months, and kind of a weird nickname, Q.
It is,
I think it's a 007 reference.
Is it? Oh, yeah, because that's maybe. Intelligence guy, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe. I think it was just like a nickname to add to an extra quirk to him, because Q is played by Rip Torn, which is an odd pick. Like, he's very much a background character in this movie.
Oh yeah, he is. Yeah. He doesn't really do much. He's just kind of there. He has like his one speech. That's basically the only thing that he does.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I have a note about. We'll get to it.
Zeev. I know. I know. It's
so hard.
It's difficult.
So hard because I have things to say, but it's not the time.
I know. Welcome to our world.
I know. Okay.
Hannah is chatting up Q. The professor interrupts their conversation. Hannah immediately puts her arm on his shoulder suggestively. Sarah sees this, and he also kind of cutely brushes her hair before he walks away. Neither action is particularly overplayed. It's all done very casually, but it's also like very touchy-feely.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely, I thought that Sarah would mention this Maybe there was a deleted scene or something, because she never comment. She sees this, but never comments on it.
Right. It does. Yeah. I mean, she mentions later on that that's probably like a reason that he doesn't want to be that.
No,
but when Tripp argues with she argues.
She only ever calls him out for wanting to stay with his wife, who's leaving him.
No, at some point, I think she says like, oh, you don't love me. You love Emily. She's young.
Yes. She says Emily.
Oh, this is Hannah. Emily.
Yeah, I actually got confused during that scene too, because the wife, the ex-wife, hadn't been named up until that point.
Oh, yeah, you're right.
Yeah, which is kind of a weird. Yeah, they should have mentioned name dropped that a little sooner.
You would think that it wouldn't have been so difficult too.
No,
like
it wouldn't
saying
have been.
Like my wife Emily left me or something.
Yeah, or even just. Like, I think that there might have been another deleted scene where she, at the party, she goes to talk to him and, like, about Hannah, and maybe they mention Emily there, but,
maybe?
Like, the reason, like, he sneaks outside for a smoke, and he looks like he's hiding from her. I feel like there was another conversation that he was trying to get away from.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
It was all... I was saw it as him leaving as kind of like being overwhelmed with just everything.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yeah.
He does leave. He goes outside for a smoke and sees James Lear standing creepily in the shadows, holding a gun.
But it's okay. It's just a cap gun.
It's just a cap gun. I carry it around like other people carry a rabbit's foot.
Mm-hmm.
And Tobey Maguire is creepy as fuck here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. The professor offers him a cigarette and he says, no, thank you. I don't like to lose control of my emotions,
mm-hmm.
which is just like, huh?
Something yeah. feels really off about that.
Yeah. He has up until about the dog scene. We'll get to that.
Yeah.
He has this era of, people were stayed away from him in high school. Like, I don't know. It's done well. The thing is, it's difficult to talk about because they're trying to make him awkward and creepy as hell. And he's doing the awkward, creepy as hell thing, like, really well. And it's supposed to make the audience uncomfortable. And it succeeds,
mm-hmm.
and they did a good job, but it still made me feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It made me feel really off about him. Even like in his very first scene, was just kind of sitting there at the writer's workshop,
mm-hmm.
And he just doesn't really do anything.
Yeah.
When Tripp leaves, he's like, can you leave the light? Can you turn the light off? And that's it. He just
sits in the darkness.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's the kind of person you instinctually don't want to turn your back on.
Mm-hmm.
And Maguire does a really good job at it.
We'll probably be in the news and not for a good thing in the future.
I mean, he was in the movie.
Oh, yeah.
So Professor is about to let him go, but... James looks at the greenhouse and mentions how he saw heaven depicted in a movie once, and this grabs Tripp's attention, so he says he tries to sneak him in to show him something in the house, but both of them are seen by Hannah and brought over to the door where everyone is leaving. Hannah introduces James to Crabtree and asks him to... recite a bunch of actor suicides, which he just keeps listing. He just keeps listing, and it's creepy and it's interesting. And Crabtree sees what Hannah's trying to show him. Like, this is a kind of weird, offbeat guy who's probably going to write some weird, offbeat stuff. Yeah. So that scene.
You can publish him. He's weird enough or something. Kind of.
I like this scene, but again, it made me feel him just listing actor suicides should be raising some red flags to any people who assume who practice psychology there.
Well, probably not. That's probably not a good thing. No. Yeah, no. His mind is doing some pretty bad stuff.
Yeah. Fixating on some pretty unhealthy things to fixate on.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to fact check like a lot of those, but a part of me was like, I don't really want to look those up either. I don't want to be brought down by just a bunch of actor suicides. No, thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a quick edit where the audience is left to infer that the professor and James just walked away from everyone. It goes from everyone in the hallway to all of a sudden they're upstairs and they're looking outside to see the last of the people leaving.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, it was just a little bump. Trip opens a safe to show James some baseball memorabilia, including the coat that Marilyn Monroe wore on her wedding day. The head of the English department is
a very big fan of Joe DiMaggio and Marilyn Monroe.
Yeah. Which James,
it's nice to have hobbies, but
yeah,
I could see it actually. Yeah.
Yeah. James quickly surmises that Trip is definitely sleeping with Sarah, because he has a good enough relationship to know the code to the hidden safe in the chancellor's bedroom. And
let's be honest, a lot of people figure it out very quickly in this
movie. Yeah, no, it's they're not subtle about it. The blind dog knows. The only one who doesn't is the husband.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which you would think that he would understand a little bit better, but
yeah. James has a depressive episode after seeing the jacket, and kind of brushes it off. And so does Trip. Trip's just like, hey, are you okay? And he says seeing it alone made him feel sad. At this point, Trip looks out the window, sees that the last of the people are going, realizes, okay, we gotta get going, we gotta go to this stupid speech being done by Q.
Yeah.
And he walks out of the room, and who's there but the blind dog growling at Trip? Do you want to describe this scene?
So Grady tries to get away, very unsuccessfully. Poe just ends up charging him, attacking his leg, just biting down really
hard. Gets a good bite on it.
Oh, yeah. You see it afterwards, too. It does not look pretty.
Nope.
And then all of a sudden, you hear two gunshots. And Grady and Trip turns around, and he sees James Lear pointing the cap gun, which is not just a cap gun at this point, but an actual gun with bullets.
So James shot the dog, and one thing I do want to mention is he shoots twice, but not in immediate succession. He shoots the dog once, there's a grunt, there's like this beat where the professor's just like, what the fuck happened? And then there's another, and then he shoots the dog again.
Oh, so he didn't really have to do the second one. That just was kind of instant.
That was just an extra.
Oh, yeah. Shoot.
And this is not the direction the movie I thought the movie was going to take. And the thing that we were alluding to that CJ cannot do is watch any movie where the dog dies.
Yeah.
Yeah. I get it.
Me too.
I get it. I'm gonna force him to watch what is it called? The John Wick movie. I'll have him skip the first 10 minutes and I'll just describe it. But yeah.
I get it. I could not sit through Where the Red Fern Grows or the other.
Fuck that movie for giving me emotions.
Right?
I
was messed up for the next 2 weeks afterwards.
They make you read it as a kid, and it's fucking sad. And then they make you watch the movie in school, and you're thinking, oh, it's fine, we're gonna watch a movie. Oh fuck, it's Where the Red Fern Grows.
Yeah.
I guess I'm gonna have my lunch while crying.
That was one middle school trauma I did not need.
Yeah. They hide the dead dog. The conversation they have on the way to the auditorium, Trip basically says, I'll take responsibility for the dog and the shooting and all that.
I love this line. Sorry.
Yeah.
When James points out that won't you get in trouble for shooting it? Trip just goes, I got tenure.
Be fine.
Yeah. That's it.
That's where his life is right now, hoping that he won't get prosecuted because he has tenure for shooting a dog.
Pretty sure that supersedes any tenure you might have had, but okay.
Yeah. So they hide the dog in the back of their car, just behind the editor's suitcase bag and his and the girl's tuba. Grady drops some codeine to take away the pain from the dog bite. Mm-hmm. James takes a pill too, but coughs it up onto Tripp's jacket after he tries to swallow it with Delta Scotch. What was that? It looked like a thing of Fireball, honestly.
Yeah, like some kind of alcohol.
Yeah.
Which is not something you should be taking codeine with, by the way.
No, I mean, that's the joke. What I think is funnier is that he drank it with straight Fireball.
Oh yeah. That I can see that. That's funny.
They go into the lecture hall. Q is about to give a speech. They are pretentious as fuck.
I am a writer. And there's just a bunch of applause.
There's a pause, everyone claps, and then it continues.
That's the easiest applause that anyone will ever get, ever.
Yeah. James spontaneously laughs during the lecture, presently high as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Gertie isn't feeling too... Gardy?
Grady.
Trip. Grady. The thing is, I keep thinking Gertie because that was the name of the brother in Ice Road.
Oh.
Yeah.
I thought you didn't want to remember Ice Road anymore.
It's a want versus can't.
Mm.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's fair. I get it.
It's there forever. It was also the first freaking movie we did.
So it's always just kind of there as it's your special movie that you do not want to remember.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's the one that I don't want to remember and can't remember. Well, there's other movies that I don't want to remember and can forget, which are nice and won't be mentioned here.
That is
good. So Trip is also starting to feel the effects of the drug as he almost passes out and leaves the theater only to pass out in the hallway and wake up with Sarah kneeling next to him. After he gets up and goes to tell her about the dog, she immediately assumes that he's about to tell her that he loves Emily. And she basically putting words in his mouth, basically saying, oh, no, you still love Emily. You guys will make it work. And I'm not going to have this baby.
Yeah. If only he had a few more minutes to kind of explain himself a bit more.
If only she wouldn't stop putting words in his mouth.
Right.
Yeah. He goes for the coat, gun slips out of the pocket, and he tells Sarah the same lame lie that James told him about it being fake. She playfully holds the gun up to his chest, whispers pow, tells him that she loves him, and then walks away. And I was just like, huh. That was a lot of whiplash. That was tonally whiplash.
Yeah. When she pointed the gun in his chest, my heart just skipped a bit. Just skipped a beat there.
I thought it would have been. Was good. It was good. James is being carried out of the theater by Terry and some other guy. I love this back and forth.
He's fine. He's narrating.
They were going to the bathroom, but would they make it in time? He's just like he's fucked out. He's trashed out of his mind. Just being dragged along, narrating everything that's happening to him.
Hey, if I did that when I was drunk or high, I would be okay with that. That sounds like a very entertaining side effect.
It's okay. He's narrating. On the ride home, Slovak, the cross-dresser, Trip gives Slovak a ride home. She sees the dog, and while removing her makeup in the car to be dropped off at her home, she tells Trip that Terry considers himself a failure, a laughingstock in New York, and he's putting all of his hopes on keeping his job on this book that Trip is writing.
We will get to it because there's like a really good moment that kind of I kind of saw as just all the pressure building up. But this is the start of it. This is when you really see that there is a lot on Trip's plate.
Yeah. Gertie, Trip heads to a bar. I wrote Gertie down on my notes, so I'm going to keep fumbling over that.
It's okay. We'll deal with it.
Truck. What a fucking... Not talking about the movie.
I was wondering when you were going to fucking bring that up, because I've been sitting here as, like, just being silent.
Oh, hey, it's CJ.
Hey, CJ. Couldn't do the silent producer?
Yeah, not so silent right now, because I've been sitting here just muttering to myself, truck.
Not going on about that.
Goodbye.
Bye,
CJ.
Okay, see ya.
Not going on about that, Zeev. If you want to torture yourself, listen to our podcast. If you want to torture yourself more, watch the movie.
Okay. Sounds good.
God.
I probably will not.
I hope that you don't. Yeah. So they go to a bar where the after party is taking place for the lecture. Hannah is dancing with Q. Terry and James are sitting together in the back corner booth. James is in a fugue state, and Trip is annoyed that Terry is, one, trying to sleep with James, and two, trying to get his book for publishing.
Right.
Terry mentions that Sarah and her husband didn't come here. They probably just want to go home and curl up on the couch with Poe, putting a fair amount of emphasis on Poe, implying that he definitely knows something. He also mentions that it's pretty clear that you guys went after my secret stash, gesturing to James.
The coding.
Yeah. The two of them then play a game. They see a man looking on the other side of the bar, chatting with someone, and they come up with a fictional backstory for him.
That actually sounds like a pretty fun game.
It does. The guy looked like, what was the, like, he really looked like,
like James Brown?
James Brown, yeah. He looked like James Brown if he got beat up in a mugging, in a, like, gang warfare.
Yeah.
And that's part of the story that they came up with.
Right.
They fumbled on the ending, but coming back to consciousness, James finishes the story.
Which means that he heard everything they said about him.
Yeah. Some of it wasn't very pleasant.
Nope.
Hannah drags Trip onto the dance floor to slow dance and goes on about how much she loves his book and how much she wants that writer's dick. She's thirsty for literature.
She really is.
Yeah. What's the word? CJ, if you're still listening, what's the word for someone who's attracted to a person attracted to intelligence?
Hang on, I'll Google it if he doesn't say anything.
Sapiosexual, thank you, buddy. Oh. Definitely a sapiosexual.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. They leave the bar, and, okay, so here's where I get a little bit confused. I know whose car it actually was. Whose car did Trip think it was?
So one of Trip's friends apparently owed him money. Like, he mentions, like, back in the beginning when when Crabtree asks about his car. And he says, my friend owed me money, so he gave me his car as collateral.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Got it. So do we ever see this friend?
We do not.
Ah, cool.
Yeah. Huh. That's just kind of a fact that they throw in there and they hope will stick.
I see.
Yeah.
Okay. Didn't stick. Didn't stick. Thank you for clarifying.
Yeah. Show don't tell is very important, folks.
Yeah.
EJ just messaged, I know a guy. Sorry, go ahead.
Yep. Hannah brings him back to the house. Trip goes with Terry and Q to pick up a bag that James left at the auditorium. While getting the bag, he notices that the dog's corpse has been moved, and at this point he's pretty positive that Crabtree knows that he killed the dog. They start driving away, and
don't forget who says the car is theirs.
Oh yes, the name, we never get his actual name. We just get the name that they invented for him.
Vernon Hardapple.
Vernon Hardapple. Even on IMDb, Richard Knox is credited as Vernon Hardapple.
That's funny. That's funny to me.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, his name is Vernon Hardapple. That's the name that they give him.
That's the name they invented for him while they were coming up with his different story.
And every time he notices that they call him that, he's like, that's not my name.
Stop calling me Vernon.
Yeah.
Vernon Hardapple is a great name for a halfling in a D&D campaign.
Oh, it is.
We got to use it sometime.
Ah, crap.
At this point, we need to use this.
Dibs. Calling all of the dibs.
Okay.
They have their cart was stolen and they need adventurers to get it back.
You find the job on Craigslist. It's just a gnome named Craig who put up a bulletin board. All right, leaving again.
Okay. One day he's going to get that silent producer thing down. It's going to be a while, but he'll get there.
It's okay.
It's fine.
This still works.
Yeah, it does. So the Vernon chases after them, yelling, "Hey, that's my car! You stole my car!" And they almost get away from him until he jumps in front of them, jumps on the hood of their car, leaving a butt-shaped dent in it, which is a weird thing to do if someone's stolen your car.
Yeah, wouldn't you want to be in good condition afterwards?
Yeah, I didn't get this.
Yeah, I was trying to think of what's a good reason for this, and the best thing that I thought is that I can identify this car afterwards, but that doesn't work because he already knows that that's his car,
right?
So I don't get it.
I don't. It's weird. It seems unnecessary. It pays off for a joke later when James is high eating donuts.
Oh yeah,
yeah. They go back to the auditorium. Alan Tudyk, weird pull, playing Traxler, opens the door for the professor to retrieve James's bag with the manuscript.
He looked so familiar, I couldn't think of who he was.
No, he's very young Alan Tudyk.
Wow.
Yeah. This was before Firefly, too. He gets the bag and James's manuscript. And he finds that Terry has hijacked his car with Q and a dead dog in the trunk to God knows where.
Sentences that you don't hear very often.
Mm-hmm. Traxler is kind enough to give the professor a ride home, and he asks about Errol Flynn putting paprika on his penis. He asks this because in the bag is a biography about Errol Flynn, and Traxler assumes the professor is reading it.
This is another fact that I wanted to look up, but I didn't because part of me did not want to know. Is it true?
Maybe.
Okay.
I went down the rabbit hole of Errol Flynn. He was the early movie actor in color with voice, and he was a singer too. Most of the things said about where Errol Flynn, there's an entire history of speculation surrounding Errol Flynn and his dick.
Wow.
Like what things he used, what STDs he had, what, like, was it above average? Was it below average? It was like a weird stuff. Also,
that is quite a rabbit hole to go into.
Yeah. Weird shit. Also, the coroner reported that when he died at a heart attack of 50, at 50, he had the body of a 75-year-old man.
Ouch.
Yeah.
Whatever he did was not good for him.
A lot of drugs.
Wow.
A lot of drugs.
Wow.
CJ wants us to know, is asking, why am I not here for the dick stuff? God damn it. All right, let's move off of Errol Flynn's paprika penis and and on to the next scene. He gets home. Professor gets home, sees James passed out on his couch, and notices a tufted bit of fur sticking out of the bag, out of his bag. And he, at first, I think, oh shit, did James cut off the dog's tail and put it in his bag?
Which would, to be fair, that would make sense for him.
Yeah. But it turns out it's not the dead dog. It's Marilyn Monroe's jacket that James stole from the safe.
Better for some things, worse for others.
He sits down to start writing his the next morning. Right. Next morning, gets up, gets a newspaper, sees that his editor has come home after a late night. Sits down, starts writing more of his book. admits
the book.
This is okay. Now we can get into the book.
Okay.
The book was originally going to be short, 200, 300 pages. And as he sits down to write, he adds page 2216, 2216 at the top, and then has an episode. Then it has an episode and blacks out. Now, I'm going to go on to the next scene, but I really first want to go on a quick diatribe on typewriters being used in movies.
Okay.
I hate it. I hate how writers are always portrayed as writing their manuscripts on a typewriter.
That's what I was thinking watching this.
It's always. The reason, I guess, is that they're trying to make it like, oh, the nostalgia of the auteur writer. He writes on a typewriter because you can't go back and change things, but can. And it's just like the concept. It's the concept of a writer. It's like it's like portraying an artist with a beret, a painter with a beret,
right.
A writer with a typewriter. It doesn't happen.
Go ahead. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you.
No, please interrupt. I can go on.
It's very much like a cliche.
It's so overused.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think
there's also a reason that, and I even noticed this before it was called out. There's a reason it's not used anymore, because it's hell to edit a typewritten work.
Yeah, because you have to type the whole thing again.
Yeah, and on top of that, I noticed this before, he's writing in single spaced on the typewriter, which means it's going to be next to impossible to edit, because you need that empty space to write in notes and shit.
I didn't even think about that. I was just thinking of all the ink he was using.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was easier to get typewriter ink back in 2000. Right now, like, if you wanted to buy it, you have to go to, like, specialty stores that make it for old typewriters. But
that sounds hard.
Yeah.
Also, you can't save your work, which comes very important later on. But we'll get to that.
We'll get to that. You're getting the hang of it.
I am. this is fun. I'm having fun.
I'm glad you are.
Yeah.
Professor, while writing, he blacks out, wakes up on the ground. James has moved him from his chair because he was worried he might swallow his tongue. This is where James points out that everything is single-spaced, but doesn't comment anything beyond that. I think it was just to hammer in the fact that he has just so much fucking writing.
So much.
Yeah.
And then he says something, and then James says something like, we all thought you had writer's block. And Tripp goes, I don't believe in writer's block. Which Lear replies, yeah, no kidding.
Yeah. He has his book, his manuscript is currently filling three separate file boxes in the corner of his room. Terry wakes up, says hi, goes to get a shower. RDJ's portrayal of a bisexual man in this movie is the kind of thing that makes heterosexual men who aren't confident in their sexuality be so scared and hateful of gays.
It did not help. It certainly did not help.
It's just like, I'm like, bisexuals of any sort tend to get kind of a bad rap.
Yeah.
But like, it's just like, I'm so often they're just depicted as sex crazed people who don't care who they're having sex with, instead of like, you know, actual humans who see things like, I don't have enough energy. I don't have enough energy to go on this tirade.
I get that. That's completely painful. Ugh. I completely understand everywhere you're coming from on that.
Yeah. Professor reminds James, after James is recovering, while he's recovering from a hangover, he says, "Hey, did I do anything bad last night?" Okay, CJ's been doing some, CJ's just texted us again. He's been going down the rabbit hole of Errol Flynn, calling him the OG Jared Leto, put a dead snake in the panties of an actress that he had sex with.
What the heck?
Yeah, it's like, it's Errol. I went down, she cried, the actress cried.
No doubt.
Oh, shit. Tell you what, CJ, I know you're listening. If we ever do a movie with Errol Flynn, we will go all in on everything about everything. Fuck yes, indeed. he just texts in all caps, fuck yeah. Okay, back to this story. No more Errol Flynn paprika penis.
Yay?
Please, CJ.
Yay.
Okay.
Of course.
CJ, do you just want to come in on this episode? We can describe the movie to you.
Okay, so it wasn't paprika, it was cocaine.
That makes it so much worse.
I'm reading that it was cocaine and it was used as an aphrodisiac. I'm not sure for who.
I mean,
I don't think it works that way.
Stop talking about Errol Flynn.
Okay.
Another time. Sorry.
I'm just going to float back into the ether now.
Thank you. Okay. Bye, CJ. The professor reminds James that he stole memorabilia and shot a dog after he asked if he did anything bad last night. At that moment,
calling the officer like very young too.
Yeah.
That's like such a small thing, but
yeah. Police cruiser pulls up to the house, asks the professor if he's seen anything strange last night at the party. They're already looking for Lear and the officer leaves. In the next scene, the professor immediately gets bombarded from every angle with all of his problems all at once. Hannah is wearing an oversized t-shirt and probably nothing else, and suggestively says, "I want to talk." Terry is wondering where breakfast is. James is mildly concerned about the police officer, and Sarah is calling him to tell him about the robbery and the missing dog. In response, the professor ignores everything except for James and leaves the house. And he injures his hand struggling to walk limping. Got the word eventually.
Which looked pretty painful, I guess.
Yeah, now the makeup was good because we didn't see a lot of it, but we did see that like there was full like bleeding where the dog bit him.
Yeah.
Oof. Picking up things at the grocery store as well as some Band-Aids, James tells the professor that he doesn't have an apartment. He's been staying at a bus station for the last couple of weeks, and that's why he has a gun for protection.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
That's a story.
That's a story.
Yeah.
It is a story.
Mm-hmm.
We'll get back to it.
Yeah, we'll get there.
They stop back at Sarah's house. Trip planned to leave a little balloon. I forget what the balloon said.
Sorry or congratulations for the baby or something like that.
Yeah, it was something very unnecessary.
Yeah.
He wanted to leave that and a note to avoid having any conversation with her, but she was already hanging out in the greenhouse.
So they had the conversation anyway.
Yep. She more or less tells him that she hasn't made any decision yet and wants to wait and see what happens with them. He leaves and chats with James about his parents while they share a joint. Trip has gone to...
It's a bit of an inconsistency, which we will get to, but James Lear, like, taking a hit of the joint when he said before he doesn't like to lose control of his emotions when he's high or he doesn't want to get high or something. Just a small thing which kind of makes sense later on.
Yeah, but, no, I didn't get. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Interesting.
Yeah.
They drive. James talks about his parents, says that he grew up in, what was it? It was the name of an ice cream company.
Hang on. I have it written in my notes.
Carvel?
Carvel, yeah.
Yeah, Carvel. It was Carvel. Carvel, Pennsylvania, and his parents were both terrible people.
His mother was a dancer, apparently, whatever kind they wanted her to be.
Yeah. And his dad worked at a mannequin factory.
Mm-hmm.
They go to the childhood home of his soon-to-be ex-wife to talk to her. James sits on the hood of the car where the butt imprint is, high on weed, chowing down on some powdered sugar donut holes.
As you do when you're high.
As you do. Professor gets James to break into the house by going through the doggy door, and Trip finds his wife's bags and things in her childhood bedroom, confirming that she did go to her parents. As James gets make yourself at home very literally, and drinks a belt of scotch and watches TV while eating those little hard candies that old people leave out.
I mean, he was certainly making himself at home there.
Yep. Trip made a phone call to Sarah, trying to tell her what's going on, and she automatically assumes that he's with her wife after he tells her where he is. She tells him that any decision is going to be made on her own time. Meanwhile, the mother-in-law and father-in-law have just come back home with groceries, and naturally they're surprised and confused to find one of Trip's students high as fuck with a little cloud hanging over him, drinking scotch on their couch.
And singing along to Good Morning. Or Good Morning to You, whatever.
I don't know.
Called.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Father offers to clean up the dog bite, which is now infected, as the mother-in-law gives some cookies and cocoa to James.
I gotta admit, they took it pretty well.
Having home invaders in their house.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. I mean, yeah.
Probably would not have worked out very well if it was another family, but
I think there's like a reactionary aspect to it. If you come home and you find someone high on your couch, it's like in Shang-Chi. You're too confused to do anything. You just run up to someone and start singing. Just sit in someone's house, get high, and eat their snacks. Like, someone comes home to that, they're not going to be angry, they're going to be confused, and then get angry.
That makes good sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. I didn't even think about Katie singing Hotel California.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's a good comparison. Wow.
Thank you.
Yeah.
the turns out the wife is somewhere else. She just left her stuff at her parents' house and she's gone traveling.
How do you feel that we don't actually ever see Emily, like aside from like a picture?
I think it's a choice. I don't think it's a bad choice. Like, we never see his wife. We see her in a picture. I think that I actually think it works for the movie because one of the big driving forces for him, for Trip, is that she's not in his life anymore.
Oh.
So, like, all these other people who are very much in his life are, like, all around him all the time, while the one person who has decided, I'm done with you, is not there.
That makes a lot of sense. I can really see that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Probably wouldn't not have been, like, very necessary to have her around then. I can see it. I can see it. Okay.
Yeah. James, while eating cookies, is concerned that the parents' dogs can smell the dead dog in the back of the car. They leave to go somewhere else, and the professor tells James that, yes, okay, yeah, I am annoyed that you shot my girlfriend's dog. He finally, like, he takes the kid gloves off a little bit. He's been, like, protective of Lear so far. But with everything going on, he's, like, a little bit done with his bullshit.
His patience is just run out at that point, or it's starting to.
Yeah. Yes, James, I am annoyed that you shot my girlfriend's dog. That's a mood. Right. Professor goes on a brief nihilistic rant, but gets cut off as James tells him that the book that he wrote is the reason he came to the school. In the rant, the professor basically says, oh, the book means... I forget exactly what he said.
Which thing are you talking about?
The book means nothing. It was something along... Writing means it's pointless. It was like the most nihilistic thing a professional writer could say.
I can't think of it, but... It's right. The writing means nothing. The book means nothing. Something like along those lines.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah,
he had a reason for it too. Trip sends James into a diner to get something to eat and calls the operator on a payphone to try to find out where his parents are. While arguing with the operator, again, the payphone in 2000. Wow.
Right. apparently, they were still used. Were they even still used?
I remember. So at the middle school, we both went to the same middle school. Right?
We did, yeah,
There were like for a while there were a couple of payphones in the front atrium.
I remember those.
I don't know if any of those ever worked.
I don't know. I was always curious about them, but I've never actually tried them.
Yeah. Basically. While talking to the operator, he says, I'm not, this isn't some, I forget exactly what he says, but
it's not like I'm making this up as I go along.
Go along, yeah. And then he realizes, oh, James, your story is a little bit stranger than fiction, stranger as fiction.
This is a thing. I watched it before, and then when I watched it again, like for the, for us, for like this podcast, I was like paying attention to like very subtle things about like James's backstory and stuff like that, that might have been wrong. And there is a lot of cliches in his stories and stuff.
Yeah. The sleeping, I was ready to believe it. On first watch, I was ready to believe everything he was saying simply because, like, I thought that was they were going to play with that theme that here's a writer who has been doing nothing with his life and therefore can't come up with something to finish writing is to actually write about. While here's James Lear who's had an interesting and weird life, and because of that, he's a good writer. But it's not, that's not the case. So I was willing to I guess the movie plays a little bit with your
like your expectations.
Ever since Game of Thrones, I've hated the phrase subvert expectations. I was more saying it plays around a little bit more with, and I'm trying to remember the word here, the ability to forget that this is a fiction. Suspension of disbelief.
Ah, yeah.
Like, early on in the movie, he's talking about his family, he's talking about where he lives, what he's doing, what he likes, and he's being portrayed as, McGuire is portraying him as a weird person, and because this is a story, the audience is trained to suspend their disbelief a little bit, so they accept this all at face value until Tripp starts to question it.
Oh. So this kind of like works well, like it kind of works on the fact that it's fiction, sort of.
Yeah. Yeah.
Ah.
In James's bag, he finds a receipt with a phone number on it. Tripp finds a receipt with a phone number on it and calls James's parents, who are wealthy, wealthy individuals on their way to a benefit. And Professor Tripp confronts James, saying, "Is anything you've told me true?" And Tripp and James starts going off like, "You don't know what it's like. They keep me locked up in the I live in the basement." And he's like, "Oh yeah, and I'm sure they lock you up below the staircase and don't feed and only feed you once a week."
With the casket of Amontillado.
Yeah,
which was a nice reference. I appreciated that.
Yeah. After the professor asks James, "Is anything that you've told me true?" And James said, what did he say? He said,
"Like, I just wanted to spend time with you or something."
Oh, that's it. Yeah. The professor sends him off with his parents, but again, James forgot and left his bag in the professor's car. He reads some of it and then heads home, only to find that Crabtree has started a house party in his home.
As your editor usually does when you're away.
Yeah. Hannah tries to throw herself at the professor again, but gets interrupted when Terry comes in. He admits that he was the one who suggested to the cops that James was acting weird at the party. And they have a brief conversation about, like, his book is really good. What was the book called? It was
The Love Parade.
The Love Parade. That's right. Yeah. Never learned what it was about, but
yeah, I don't think they ever talk about it.
Yeah. They decide to break James free from his parents. And they find that he actually does live in his parents' basement, just filled with overdue library books. And again, hey, look, it's a fucking typewriter.
Yep.
Yep, another typewriter. Anyway, they find...
That's how you know he's a writer.
Yeah, yeah. on the typewriter, they find that he's written a page from his perspective of the... conversation he had with the nihilistic conversation they had in the car, basically a never meet your heroes sort of vibe to it. Like, he saw that this writer that he idolized was just a broken man and was clearly dealing with that.
Yeah.
Which
is honestly kind of like Tripp's whole thing right now at this point.
Yeah. They do get him out of his room, but he says, "No, my mom pops in every 30 minutes. How are we going to do with, what are we going to do with that?" And they decide to leave the dead dog in his bed as a decoy for his parents.
That's not the best idea I've ever thought of.
No, but... it's probably the worst.
Yeah.
Like, They even mention pillows. I don't know why. Like, it's a weird decision.
I don't know.
Yeah. When they get back to the professor's house, Crabtree nabs the manuscript that James wrote, and Trip finds Hannah asleep in his bed with pages of his manuscript.
Oh, she was reading it, yeah.
Yeah, well, trying to. There's a lot. Trip calls Sarah as a van pulls up to his house, then rapidly speeds away. Walter picks up, not Sarah, and Trip just tells him, "I am in love with your wife," and just hangs up.
You know, he's had a bad enough weekend as it is. You might as well just throw that in there. Yeah.
Next day, Trip stares at a blank page as Sarah drives up to his house. He admits to having James in his house and tells her that Marilyn Monroe's jacket is in his car, but it looks like his car has been stolen. Rouses James from sleeping, tells him he has to go with the police, but not before Crabtree tells the professor that he's definitely going to publish his book. Also, they spent Crabtree and James spent the night together, which like isn't overly pointed out. It's just like, oh yeah, that happened.
Yeah, it's definitely noticeable, but they don't really say a lot about it.
Yeah, it's just like, yeah, that happened.
Yeah.
Trip and Crabtree plan to go after the stolen car, but need to borrow Hannah's car first. And she says, "I'll let you read the. I'll yeah, sure, you can borrow my car, but can I? I didn't finish your manuscript." She probably finished the first fifth of it.
If even.
And any lust she had for any sapiosexual lust died after she says, "It didn't feel like you made any choices."
Mm-hmm.
And I love that line because it just kind of summarizes Tripp's entire life that we've seen in this movie.
It does.
He doesn't do, he's not an active participant in his own life, it feels like.
Everything just kind of happens to him in this.
Yeah. Also, she suggests that he was under the influence while writing it. He immediately gets super defensive, basically saying, I was also under the influence when I accepted my award for this. So,
I'm sure he doesn't have a problem. He's fine.
Oh, yeah. No, he's perfectly awesome.
Yeah.
Takes the three boxes of books downstairs of downstairs.
Not books. It's all one book.
I think this was only there because they find the car and the manuscript. They bring the manuscript for some reason.
Yeah.
I think the editor just wanted to read it as they were going. But I don't know.
I think it's only because it's part of it. I can kind of understand because Trip got very defensive about it and he just wants to keep it on himself to like guard
protect it.
Yeah, to protect it. Part of me is also thinking that it's to set up what's going to happen.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
I get it.
It makes character sense, but why would you leave it in the front seat?
You should not do that.
Wouldn't. How could it fit in the front seat?
I don't think it can.
Yeah.
You need like an actual person to sit there too. And he's sitting there. So. Yeah.
Anyway, they remembering the name on the van that passed by last night. They immediately find the car. Trip goes in to get the bag out of the car, which has the jacket in it.
Actually, it does not have the jacket in it.
But what he does, so he doesn't find the jacket, but he does find the little gun in the glove compartment and then has another blackout episode. And when he regains consciousness, he sees the waitress from that night at the after party, and then is immediately has a gun put in his face by the man they have named Vernon. Vernon says, "Get out of my car and drop the gun." And instead of dropping the gun, he says, "No, it's a toy. It's not an actual really gun." And he just keeps saying, "Drop the gun." All he has to do is drop the toy gun that he's lying about. Thinking that he's instead of dropping the gun, Trip shoots a hole through the roof of the car. Thinking that he's going to help, Crabtree drives past them so Trip can jump into the car. But instead, Crabtree loses control, and with the passenger side door open, he crashes into a wall, and all the pages of the manuscript go flying into the wind.
I felt the pain there.
Oh,
I felt the pain of just all having all of that work just fly away.
Yeah, Trip looks heartbroken. Crabtree is like going after pages a little bit. Trip says, "Okay," it says to the man they named Vernon, "Okay, you can shoot him now."
Oh.
The man they've named Vernon, because that's what I'm going to keep calling him, and the waitress are a couple. The waitress is pregnant. And they are, even after all this, they're kind enough to drive them back to the university.
Can we talk about what coincidence it is that the man named Vernon and the waitress are a couple?
I like that. That's the kind of stuff that I kind of expect in an offbeat movie about offbeat writers.
Yeah,
like where their reality of weird stuff, their fiction of weird stuff, is influenced by their reality of weird stuff. Like I think there's a kind of nice parallel connections with that.
Yeah, I like that. That makes a lot of sense.
The editor apologizes. Well, he doesn't apologize. He's more along the lines of, "I'm sorry that happened," and says that maybe it was some kind of sign that the copy of 2,000 plus pages of manuscript got thrown to the wind. The man named Vernon tells Crabtree, "Yeah, that's stupid, and you're a dumbass."
And, which is the only logical reply to something like that.
Trip admits that after a beat of silence, Trip admits that they ask him, "Okay, I'm sorry you lost your book. What was it about? Could you rewrite it? Could you redo it?" And Trip admits he doesn't know what the book he was writing was about. He has no idea. And when they get back to university...
Oh, wait. Sorry, I actually... This is something that I was talking about before. But then the man named Vernon asked him, "So if you don't know what it was about, why were you writing it?" And Trip just says, "I couldn't stop." And I really like that because it just shows how much pressure everyone has been kind of putting on him, that he's been writing something that he's probably aware will not work for his editor, but he knows that he's got to, you know, like live up to that expectation of like writing a bestseller like The Arsonist's Daughter.
Yeah.
That he's just kind of put himself in this limbo where he has to write, but he can't ever stop writing.
I kind of see it as he has built this personality for himself as a writer. And there might be an aspect of, if I'm not writing, he doesn't see it as maybe he doesn't see it as publishing. Maybe he sees it as like, if I'm not writing, I'm not a writer.
Maybe. Yeah.
That's one take. I don't know if it's the take they were trying to do with this movie. Because like the book he was writing, I don't really know what this movie is about.
I think it's about, I don't know if this is one of those situations where we'll get there, but I think it's more about like the characters than the situation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. After they get dropped off at the university, Trip says, tells the waitress that that jacket belonged to Marilyn Monroe and she can keep it. And then he talks to Crabtree a little bit. I forget exactly what the lines were, but the philosophizing about being about teaching and being a writer and being a writer that teaches felt like he was trying to have a like shoehorned in thesis for the movie, which kind is, of? I guess, why I was a little bit confused by that. Like, it was so, the whatever thesis it was so vague as to,
it was like,
weird.
Yeah, the starting sentence that I have in there is, nobody teaches a writer anything. And I didn't write down the rest of it, but I should have.
Yeah.
But yeah, it feels like it was kind of a thesis of like, the best thing I can kind of say is that it was about life experiences and how they relate to a writer, but I don't, that seems kind of weak to me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. Like, it doesn't fit with the movie. Like, this conversation did not fit with the rest of the movie.
Right. Yeah. It didn't.
Like this scene could have been cut and I'd be fine with it.
Right.
But it's, yeah. We see at the auditorium, James gets a standing ovation for his recent sale of his book to a publisher.
To
Crabtree.
Right. Small note. At the awards, I don't know if you noticed, but next to Hannah Green is Mac from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. Robert McElhenney, I think.
Oh,
that's
wow.
How we say name. Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah. Apparently, he was supposed to have more of a thing, but they cut out most of his scenes. So
interesting.
That just kind of stayed in there.
Huh.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Right?
Kind of sucks for him.
Oh, very.
Yeah. At the ovation, they also announce that Walter, the husband, has also sold his book for publishing. Crabtree was able to get him to drop charges in exchange for publishing his book. And as the title of the book is called The Last American Marriage, I think it can be surmised that he's leaving her.
Yeah.
Yeah.
After what happened and everything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Also, he knows that she's pregnant at this point, I think, especially after they talked and he learned that Trip loved her.
Oh, I'm sure that there was a whole conversation about that. Yeah.
Yeah. The people go to leave. Trip tries to get to Sarah to talk to her. After not being able to find her, he gives up, gives his weed to Traxler, almost has another fainting spell, and falls off, and could have fell off the, he's like up on the fourth floor.
Like on a balcony, kind of.
Yeah, and Traxler's down, like, cleaning plates and stuff, cleaning the floor. He gives him the weed, he has this little blackout moment, but he catches himself. And then we get this final scene where the movie ends with him typing what I guess is an autobiography of this this period of his life.
Yeah.
This weekend of this of his life.
Yeah, this and, whole movie takes place in a weekend. That's that yeah. still baffles me.
No, I like that. I think that works really well for the timing. Okay. He is writing on a early 2000s computer and not a typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And then Sarah shows up in front of his house carrying a baby.
Yep.
Roll credits.
Wait, no. He hits save on the computer and then roll credits. Save your work, folks.
God. I think he should have died.
Really?
I think he should have died. I think it would have left a more narrative like finish to it.
I don't know. I kind of like that he didn't. I'm a sucker for happy endings, honestly. But I feel like that kind of, after this whole weekend sort of turned his life like upside down, it sort of shows that he was okay after that, you know, that he had something to work with.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing, like, that one ending scene is the difference between this being a tragedy and a comedy. And, like, I think that's... God, I'm actually... this watching this movie made me want to watch a better movie about writing and story called Stranger Than Fiction. Have you seen that?
I have. I like that movie.
It's a good movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, like, I don't know. I think his death at the end caused from the blackouts that he's been having because of stress. Like, yeah, I think it could have worked either way. I just would have liked this better if he had died.
Okay. I can see where you're coming from. I disagree. I think it works pretty well that he didn't, but
It works pretty well. I just think it would have worked a little bit better.
I can understand that. Yeah.
Yeah. Times I feel like this, like, we talked a lot about our feelings as we were watching it. Usually me and CJ will summarize near the end. So I feel like we've said a lot about this. I feel like this movie ironically is overwritten. Like, I don't know how else to say that. Like, I don't like the, I wrote this story based on my life. I like this movie could work just as good, if not better, without the narration.
Okay. Kind of like if they used, instead of the narration, a little bit more showing of what it was. Yeah. That,
or even just introductions of people to people.
Yeah. Definitely. I think I would have liked I can see what you mean about the narration. I think if they have done a little bit less a little bit more of show don't tell, like in terms of Grady's opinions and kind of his like when his wife left him, instead of it just coming through narration, I think that would have worked out pretty good.
Like trinkets she left behind in his in the house, this, that, or the other. Like they could have done a lot more. Like, allegedly they were living together. And like the other thing is, the women characters in this movie do not feel like they contribute a lot. They just seem to be like acting forces.
I just kind of realized this. Yeah, none of the female characters actually do anything in this movie, do they?
Yeah, Hannah is just there as like a potential stress reliever. I guess she's interested in him until she realizes, oh God, he can't actually write a sentence. He can't actually finish a book. Frances McDormand, she was so underutilized in this.
Yeah.
The text of the movie shows that she's trying to work this out for herself, but we only ever see things from Tripp's perspective. So rather than her trying to figure out what she's doing with her life, and rather than us seeing her go through that process, from Tripp's perspective, she just seems indecisive.
Like,
and just like an added aspect of stress for him.
Yeah. It, like, do you think it would have been better if they haven't focused on Tripp as much and a little bit more on Sarah?
I think this is about Tripp, and I think they could have focused on, they could have like broken away from Michael Douglas's character into other stories going on with other people.
Yeah.
If they weren't so tied to the narration aspect of it.
In the background, like near the beginning, like you can tell that there's a bit of a thing going on between like this kind of goes off on that sort of, like there's a sort of a background story that's happening between Sloviak, Crabtree, and then later James, kind of. I don't know if you've noticed, like sort of in the background, like when Crabtree introduces Slovia. I hope I'm saying her name right. They seem to be happy. And then afterwards, Crabtree's meeting James.
Oh, yeah.
He's a little bit more interested in
the moment. Him. Yeah. The moment Crabtree meets Lear, he's like, oh, new toy.
Yeah.
And Slovak.
Thank you.
Is just like, yeah, I kind of knew what I was getting into when I was talking to him.
Yeah.
I
think it would have been nice if that was not just like a background thing, if that was something that was actually a bit more forefront.
Yeah, like Crabtree bouncing around between people, like maybe like have him like come down with Hannah like after she read the book.
Yeah,
I don't know. It was a character trait that they didn't like lean on. Also, I feel like Slovak was only there so people could narrate, it could talk to the audience to tell who these people are and what's going on.
That kind of feels like that. Yeah,
like carted off before the halfway point of the movie.
Yeah. Also,
she was carted off right after we were introduced to everyone.
Right, like she was just there for the beginning and then just kind of went home and never really...
And disappeared, yeah.
Also the tuba. What was up with the tuba?
I kept waiting for that to get paid off. Yeah, Slovak had... there was no way that was a tuba. It was the case was far too small to be a tuba. It was maybe a sousaphone or a... Oh, what's that other instrument? It was...
French horn?
Like... Horn front didn't look like a horn. I can imagine the shape of it. Anyway, it was a small brass instrument, medium small brass instrument, and the case was in like a cowskin, like had a cowskin cover over it.
Yeah,
and it never there was never any payoff. I thought maybe the dog might get shoved in there. I thought maybe the drugs might get shoved in there. It's there. We don't even see the instrument. We just see the case. And Slovak appears, then leaves. And they take their case.
Yeah. The only thing that I can think of is that it sets up like a joke that between James and Tripp, where James recounts on the trunk, wow, it fits a couple of suitcases, a tuba, and a dead dog. Back and Tripp just says, yep, just like they say in the ads. And I think that's all they really put in there.
That was it. But it had all the beats of planting, reminder, and reminder again, and then no payoff.
Right.
And it was just like, was that, I don't know.
It feels kind of bad. I get
it
that.
It feels awkward in a movie that was so like, dependent and playing around. I guess maybe it's God, I hate how those fucking writers on Game of Thrones ruined the phrase subvert expectations.
Yeah,
but maybe it was a subversion of expectations.
Kind of, I guess, sort of,
this entire thing was about writing, and the planting payoff is a big part of that, and they basically bring out what's that writing phrase with a gun? Chekhov's gun.
Yeah.
And it doesn't go off.
Like if there's a gun that shows up in the first act, it will go off at some point.
Yeah.
Yeah. And that just never really happens.
No. Well, that's the thing. They do Chekhov's gun, and then they don't do Chekhov's gun with the thing that isn't a gun.
Oh, yeah. Wow. I'm thinking maybe because this was based off of a book, right?
Yes. The writer of the novel, Michael Charbon, was also a writer for Spider-Man 2.
Really?
Yes, and is currently a writer for Star Trek Picard.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Yeah, he's a... He also did the screenplay for John Carter, which was average. They wanted to try to bring back a golden age superhero, and it just didn't work.
Oh, that's the one where he goes to Mars or something, isn't it?
Yeah, John Carter of Mars.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was didn't really work very well.
Yeah. How would you eat this, Zeev? You're familiar with our thing.
Yep. Yeah, like raisin, mangoes, blueberries, right?
Yep.
You know, when I saw it originally, there's a lot that I did appreciate it and I liked this that made me want to think that it was like a blueberry. But now, like, after watching it and like thinking about it a little bit more, and there are issues with it. So it's probably closer to just the mango, like the mango aspect. So I would say that this would probably be some sort of mango creme brulee, if that's a thing. And then, yeah. And then I would write about 2,000 pages of a review on it. Would need to, anyway.
Yeah. For me, this is like a short novel printed on thin sheets of mango speckled with blueberry dust.
Oh, yeah.
It's kind of overwritten, and the story moves along brisk enough pace to keep you interested. And like there are moments like when the dog got shot, I was like, huh, that's something. There's occasional moments where things just get, you know what it felt, you know what this really felt like? It felt like it had like the texture of a Coen Brothers film, but not the writing to back it up.
I can see that. Yeah.
Like it reminded me of Stranger Than Fiction. It reminded me of Burn After Reading. It reminded me of A Serious Man in just this, like, the general idea of it. Like, the general feel of it, of, like, things happening. But it didn't have the rhythm that those movies did.
Yeah. Like, it tried to be something like it, but it didn't really work that way.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Oh, well. All right. I still enjoyed it for.
I enjoyed it.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. I recommended it to my parents. I think this is a good. I think it's a decent. It's worth watching. Like if you have nothing else to watch.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a solid movie. It's just bumpy.
It is. There are some things that it could have done better. Definitely.
Yeah.
But yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's all we have for the podcast this week. Zeev, I want to thank you again for being on the show. I hope to get you back here sooner, maybe with CJ here, not just posting Errol Flynn stories in chat.
Whenever you guys want me again, you know how to reach me. This was fun. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Came on. You the listener can reach us at chilling catthemangoes at gmail.com. You can find us and all of our work at cathemangoes.buzzsprout.com. Our Twitter is at chilling_mango. Our Facebook is at Cat Mangoes, and we just started a Discord. So please join us at Chilling Amongst the Mangoes on Discord. Me and CJ are going to be on it. Zeev's going to be on it.
I'm on there right now.
We'd love to chat with you guys. What your ideas are about movies? What you might want us to do in the future? We'd love to hear it. Thank you again so much for watching. Thank you again, Zeev, for coming on. You can also everyone, you can find all of this information in the description of the episode below. Thank you and have a great day.
See ya.
Bye.